Welcome today to an interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Chris Harrison, Editor-in-Chief of ACM Crossroads, and he's a Microsoft Research PhD Fellow. Chris, thank you for coming in today to share your deep experiences and cumulative insights with our audience.
Thank you for having me.
Chris, how did you get first interested in computing, and when did this occur?
Well, I got my first computer in roughly third grade, and my parents bought this machine, quite honestly, because my handwriting was pretty terrible. And so they thought moving to kind of typing, which was fairly kind of new at that time, certainly I was one of the few kids in the class that had a computer, and so I was able to type all my documents and make it kind of legible for my poor teachers. And I ended up spending a lot of time on this machine, quickly learning everything about it. I mean, I must have clicked on every possible button in that machine very fast. And having always been fond of tinkering, in many ways, this was kind of the ultimate tinkering tool. And so that really was the start of my experiences in computing and my kind of love of computing as well.
Well, can you share your research on novel interaction techniques and input technologies?
Certainly. So in short, my research aims to create ways to interact with small devices in large ways. So generally, when you miniaturize a device, you have to simultaneously shrink the input area. And that's led to small buttons and tiny touchscreens and so on. So what I think about is ways to let devices continue to be small or even potentially become smaller, but simultaneously not decreasing their usability, which is a problem that we're generally seeing here.
I see. So do you follow the work then of Jonathan Ives at Apple and things like that?
A little bit. I mean, certainly Apple is kind of a paradigm leader in mobile devices, certainly, with things like the iPhone and iPods. And so I definitely keep up on trends like that. There's a lot of great work that's also coming out of academia from all over the world. There's an entire ACM conference dedicated to it, in fact, called the ACM Computer-Human Interaction Conference, where a lot of these kind of interaction techniques and input devices are showcased. To really solve this problem of we just can't shrink buttons, we can't just shrink devices down to the size of rice grains without them being unusable. So there's a really strong impetus right now to find ways to keep interactions big, like we have on laptops and desktops, but let them become increasingly mobile. And that's actually a really tough question to do because we're up against physical constraints. You can't just make buttons smaller. You know, our fingers are a certain size, and simultaneously we can't make screen smaller because our eyes have only a certain amount of acuity. So we basically, devices now are much more, their size is much more defined by human factors than it is by computing factors. So if you take a modern device like an iPhone, the reason it's that size is not because Apple couldn't make a smaller device. It's that size because if it was any smaller, we wouldn't be able to use it. So the screen is that size so we can read it. The buttons are that size so we can press them. But Apple could potentially fit all that technology into something like a wristwatch, but we wouldn't be able to use it.
I see. Well, you know, it's interesting. You're a Microsoft Research PhD fellow. So have you actually interacted at all with Chuck Thacker? Because he did some early work with the tablet PC and sort of given credit for some of that work that's occurred with the tablet PC.
Right. So no, I haven't interacted directly with him. But I do have kind of ongoing collaborations with several Microsoft researchers. I was there actually only for a summer this past summer. So my experiences with them have been somewhat limited despite the fact that I was able to receive this PhD fellowship from them.
Can you describe your work at IBM Research?
Certainly. So IBM Research, I actually interned there back when I was an undergrad, actually between my undergrad and my master's degrees. And I worked on a project which at the time was called Enki, which is the Sumerian god of knowledge. That was kind of its code name. And it was a tablet-based project, interestingly. And we wanted to build something that a professional could carry around to their meetings with a pen, kind of with a stylus, and jot down things about people, about meetings, and about events. So when you go to an event, like a meeting with five people, you could write down various things right onto the screen about that event. And then you could also, let's say someone mentioned, oh, you know, my kid is getting some soccer trophy, or my daughter is pregnant or something. They could write in that person's profile, again, right on the screen, little notes about them. And all this information was kind of assembled behind the scenes into a kind of a semantic web. So when you had a meeting later with the same person, it would say, hey, look, you know, this woman was going to have a kid, you know, and maybe that's an opportunity to say, hey, you know, how's your child doing? And that could foster a relationship, kind of a professional relationship with them. So it was really a way to have all this disparate information get pulled together in a very seamless way. The other thing we experimented with, and it was a really neat idea, was have the device, which was just getting to the computational power necessary to do this was to listen to everything going on in the room and through its microphone and try to translate it as best as could. Now, it might have only had 50% accuracy, but that was okay. And what we were looking for is keywords. You say, oh, what about project XYZ? And then the computer would get that out maybe 50% of the time, and it'd search through all of its emails and meetings and people's resumes and everything that was in this system. And it could say, hey, you know, you had a meeting about this project 2 months ago, and you got a CV from Bill Schmidt that worked on this project as a senior engineer. And it basically just have a kind of a, almost like a kind of tweets, kind of like this rolling window of information, so you could glance at your tablet and say, oh, hey, you know, I know this guy who was working on that project, you know, 2 months ago. So it's a way to really collect this massive amount of information that we deal with as information workers and as just business professionals, and put it into kind of a super tablet.
Well, that's interesting. So it very much relates to sort of the needs of the information worker today and into the future. What work did you do at AT&T Labs?
Yeah, so now this was one after I had graduated my master's. So this is between my master's and PhD. So I kind of kept on going back for little stints at different organizations. At AT&T Labs, I ended up working for about a year there. What we worked on, I worked on actually a number of projects, but the central project was this collaborative television system. What we realized, and I think what AT&T realized as an organization that was moving into the television market, the cable companies had already been starting to deliver internet and phone and TV, and AT&T was starting to gear up on that effort too, is they realized within, you know, 5 years, and this was back 3 years ago now, within 5 years they realized everyone was going to be watching TV content asynchronously. So that is, they're going to be watching it out of time. They're going to be watching it on their DVRs. They're going to be watching it on Hulu. They're going to be watching it online. They're going to be watching via DVDs from Netflix. No one was going to be consuming media necessarily as it broadcasted. And the big problem with that is television is a very central facet to Western culture, really, in many ways, global culture now. So people are watching Lost. They want to know about, you know, the season finale. But the problem is your friend is going to watch it on the weekend. Another friend is another season behind you, and so on. So basically what is described as kind of the water cooler effect, where people could walk up and chat about, you know, last night's shows, is really diminishing. So to give you kind of a reference point on that, back when I Love Lucy was on the air, 2/3 of all Americans watched that show. So when they went into office the next day, 2/3 of the people could be at the water cooler and talking about that episode. And that really was an opportunity for people to interact, provide a kind of a social lubricant in many ways. But now people are doing it asynchronously. You go into the office and basically no one has seen the show that you have. And that's a real loss. Same with even within families, unless you're sitting down physically next to the people watching it. So what we did is we built this social television system that basically, when you watch the show, a little virtual avatar of yourself sat down in the front of the audience. And there's actually a YouTube video that I can provide for you guys. So there's a little virtual avatar that sat down in the front of the audience. You kind of saw it silhouetted against the show. And that was you. And you could type comments and wave your hands, like do different gestures by pressing different buttons on your remote control. Now, let's say you finished the show and you ended. Now when your friend comes on, he sits down in this kind of virtual audience to it. But what's also happening is that it sees an avatar of you as well. So now there's two people in that audience. And as he's playing the show, all these little comments come up from you that you left in the show, but you're not actually watching along with him, but it looks like you are, because you're kind of making comments in the show in situ. And what happens is over time, you have like 10 people watch this, all of a sudden now you have an entire virtual audience with all these people waving their hands and doing thumbs up and thumbs down gestures and making little kind of witty remarks about the show or, you know, continuity errors. And it actually makes it really lively. We ran a study on this and people actually loved it. They loved being able to communicate and leave little jokes, even if they were the... So there's two parts. One is that you watch the show in the beginning, and you're the first person there. So then you know that all of your comments are going to be seen by future people. And then if you're at the very end, like you're the last person to watch the show, you get to enjoy all the commentary from people before. So that actually works on both ends of the spectrum, which is important, because no one wants to contribute to a system where no one's going to see the comments. So that was basically the main idea, so this kind of a social collaborative environment when you're assuming everyone's watching media out of sync with each other.
That's kind of interesting. So do you see applications of that right now? You know, let's say BD Live or some of the other kinds of vehicles that are out there or platforms?
A little bit. I haven't kept up a tremendous amount on the social TV kind of technology. I still think the work that we did at AT&T Labs is still probably state-of-the-art, and it's kind of a highly cited paper in that community. It's a very visual idea, so I encourage your viewers to check out the video online. The project name is Collabra TV, so the last two letters are just TV instead of collaboration. But It hasn't quite emerged yet because we're continuing to watch a lot of media live, or people are recording it on their DVRs, and they're very disparate platforms. So if some person is with one cable company, another person is with another cable company, it breaks because there's no kind of compatibility between the two systems. But I do think kind of platforms like YouTube or Hulu, which have a lot of viewers traversing them, have a real golden opportunity to enhance that experience. I mean, if you look at just comments in YouTube, which are just a linear kind of like almost discussion board, those are extremely well trafficked, have thousands of comments on many videos, but they're not tied into the show. And you say, aha, that was a really funny joke. That's just a standalone comment. It doesn't give it any kind of context in the video. So I think there's a lot of opportunities in this space, and I'm disappointed there hasn't been more work done in them, but it's coming, so stay tuned.
Yeah, that's where I'm thinking this Blu-ray Live, Blu-ray Disc Live from Sony, it seems to have some of the feel that you're talking about, you know, where you're watching a movie and you can look at sort of the community interaction with that movie. And you can do it in real time, and you can look at prior comments. It seems like it has some of the feel that you're talking about.
Right. So I'm actually not exactly familiar with that system, but I wouldn't be surprised if they're starting to inch towards this kind of vision at this point.
So what was the focus of your work at Microsoft Research?
So this was an entirely different kind of theme of project, much more aligned with my dissertation work at Carnegie Mellon. Basically what we wanted to do, and this is very much tied in with this notion of devices getting too small to use. So rather than having a device be large, kind of, that you have to put in your bag, we wanted to have the surface area be, you know, equal to that potentially of a laptop or like a tablet or certainly a phone, but not have to have the bulk of a laptop or a phone. And so we kind of looked around the environment and said, what are opportunities for surface areas? We want to have a device that's really small. It's going to need to steal surface area from somewhere. And we ended up doing the skin. So it turns out the nice thing about skin is that it's a surface area that goes everywhere with you. This is unlike tables or walls or chairs or like a big flat screen TV. You don't want to transport those with you. But your skin has about 2 square meters of surface area and, you know, goes wherever you're with you. Don't, you know, leave your arm behind at work. It obviously goes wherever you go. So what we wanted to do is look at if we could take advantage of the skin and actually turn it into an interactive surface. And what we did is we built this very specialized array of these bioacoustic sensors. And they're very much like a stethoscope that a doctor would use listening inside of your body. And these could listen to basically taps, so finger impacts on your skin. So the kind of tapping, you know, the tip of your finger or like a snap of a finger or a flick of a finger. And it could listen to the acoustic profile, the kind of acoustic fingerprint of that noise and say, yes, that was very much like Chris's, you know, finger snap, or that sounds like Chris tapping on his wrist. And with that knowledge, the computer being able to classify those different points, we coupled that with a projector so that we could project buttons simultaneously onto the user. And then you basically had something that was equivalent to almost a full-up touchscreen, but your skin was both the projection surface and the button surface simultaneously. So it was quite a successful project at Microsoft, and I kind of think it opened up some people's eyes to realizing that there's a lot of opportunities for devices to be small, assuming they can take advantage of surface area and volume in the environment.
So does that relate to or could be melded with, for example, where they're embedding projection capability into contact lenses?
Right. I mean, so there's a whole work, and actually the team that I worked with at Microsoft Research has done a lot on contact lenses, for example, but in general has this notion of always available computing, and primarily by doing it on your body. So there's been a big vision of having mobile devices, but they're kind of heavyweight in many ways and are still very much constrained to their surface area of the device. They're limited by the physicality of the device. So an iPhone is only going to be as big as the iPhone itself and never bigger. And we don't want to carry around, you know, laptops and tabs and iPads and such. You are, but it comes with the expense of having to carry around a larger device. So Apple, to make kind of a supersized iPhone, ended up making the iPad. But now the iPad doesn't fit in your pocket. But it'd be nice to do everything an iPad does on an iPhone, but, you know, keep it at the same size. So it's very much a design constraint. But yes, we're trying to get to this vision of, we want to, you know, mobile phones with internet capabilities have opened up tremendous opportunities for information and for communication and for creativity, like wherever we are. It's very much a dream of ubiquitous computing, which was drawn out in the late 80s. What we want to do is advance that vision even more by having this computing always available to us, because in many ways the human is the computing platform. So we don't have to pull out any explicit device. We can almost kind of have interfaces just summoned onto our body. And so that is even more kind of ubiquitous computing.
Do you see some intersection between your work and Project Natal?
Absolutely. So the thing with Project Natal is that it very much has the same vision, but the sensors are kind of planted in front of your TV. So you can do those interactions while you're in front of your, you know, home theater setup. But as soon as you walk away from Project Natal, or you go outside, or you're in the subway, those interactions aren't available to you. So how do you have those kind of capabilities? Gestural, pointing, voice communication, clicking on buttons, etc., when you're on a train if you don't have an explicit infrastructure. So that's very much installing a sensor infrastructure into your house. And what we haven't seen is equivalent sensor infrastructures be deployed all over the world. We don't have them in the subways and on the trains and, you know, while we're walking to work and then even in our offices. So how do we have an infrastructure that goes with us everywhere we go? And we think we need to basically put computing on the body. And not just putting computers on the body, which is very much like what wearable computing kind of researchers have been doing, but actually make computing kind of seamless on the body so that I can just pull out my hand, you know, dial a phone number on it and then put it up to my ear. There's almost no devices that you could point at. It's almost woven into the fabric of your clothes and of your body.
Sounds interesting. It sounds like Minority Report, that movie, but without having the surrounding infrastructure. It's all self-contained within you.
Exactly.
Can you profile your work at Disney Imagineering?
So this is actually a fairly new research engagement that I've gotten involved with. Disney operates a lab in Pittsburgh, right near Carnegie Mellon, for R&D purposes. And I've teamed up with some researchers there on some really interesting haptics research. And unfortunately, I can't talk a tremendous amount about it, but what we're trying to work on is multi-touch haptics. So basically, right now, when you have a device, when it vibrates, all of your fingers that are grabbing the device vibrate, because it's a mechanical motion. What we want to do is have each finger feel a different haptic response so that you can actually have, you know, two fingers on the display or two users on the display, and each can feel a different haptic sensation. So it's right now we have kind of multi-touch devices that are single vibrotactile output. So how do we do that but with multiple fingers?
I see. And what do you see as the ultimate applications of this in your mind?
Well, haptics have been shown to be really useful in things like typing. So if you the great thing about physical keyboards is that you can feel them. You can type, you can touch type on them. No one can touch type on their iPhones because it's just a flat screen. So physical cues are really important for humans to do accurate input. And if we can port some of, these cues to touchscreen displays, which I think now has become, people have realized, touchscreen displays where you can have the whole device be allocated to touchscreen use is really valuable. I think the iPhone kind of proved this 2 or 3 years ago at this point, and other device manufacturers have followed. But the problem with touchscreens is, again, there's no physicality. So how can we get haptics back onto the touchscreens, but without making it permanent? And in many ways, when we're doing kind of multi-finger operations, like touch typing, for example, how do we deliver haptic feedback to each finger individually?
I guess we're really now curious about this new role that you have as Editor-in-Chief of the Association of Computing Machinery, or ACM, and this publication called Crossroads, which is now XRDS, rather than the word spelled out in full, so XRDS. Can you tell us more about why the ACM is introducing a redesigned tech-savvy magazine for graduate and undergrad students this year called Crossroads, or XRDS, and can you tell us more about this publication, your goals, and why readers out there will want to engage? And are you looking for a broad audience besides graduate and undergrad students as well?
Right. So foremost, it's important to note that students are the future of computing. And that is what ACM realizes. In fact, ACM was founded to support the discipline of computer science and computing. So it's very much ACM's goal to engage with this community and support them. And we want to help students in particular to connect with each other, to learn, to enjoy computer science as a field. That's very much ACM's core goal, and XRDS is there to really provide all three of those things. Also, students are the future of ACM, so we want students to become successful professionals, influence the field of computer science, and also influence ACM. I mean, ACM is a professional organization, so it really is the sum of its members. And we want the best members to be engaged with the ACM so we can help shape the organization's future. In terms of what we want people to engage with is that we have an open submission model. So we often have thematic issues on cloud computing or kind of on-the-go computing or mobile devices or the future of gaming. What are IDEs going to look like in 20 years' time? Are we still going to be using you know, Visual Studio and Eclipse. We have whole issues dedicated to those, and we'd love for readers to contribute their thoughts either online or on the discussion boards we have on our website, or and also to submit articles. So there's lots of ways that we want to engage with the professional and student communities. With that being said, it is a student magazine for graduate and undergraduate students in particular, and the reason why we have a special magazine for them is they have unique interests and unique kind of items to cater to. So in particular, they want to know advice like, how do I get into a grad school? How do I transition from undergrad to grad school? What are the best places to get an internship? And what places are doing the latest work? So these are issues that students think about and we want to deliver answers to. But we also are always interested in getting professionals interested, and the quality of the content I think you'll find is very high. But the way that professionals can get engaged in this publication is that we're very much looking for their articles as well. So even though it's a student magazine, not all the articles are written by students. In fact, we have a very nice mix at present. And so if people are interested in shaping the future of computing and doing that by basically influencing the students, which are the next generation computer scientists and IT professionals, this is a great place to do that. It's a great venue to do that. And right now, like the issue that we're just about to send out this summer has got people from Autodesk and Microsoft Research and all sorts of fantastic places. So we'd very much like to hear from people if they're interested in writing an article.
So what are you going to do to make this really exciting and cool, because, you know, to help create sort of a stickiness with this publication?
Right. So it's really a multi-tiered effort. So foremost, ACM has, I think, something like 30,000 student members. So this magazine actually goes out to a tremendous number of people. In fact, more subscribers than, you know, some magazines you find on store shelves. So it is a very large student population. And the way we're trying to make it exciting, and I briefly touched on this before, is delivering them content that's useful to them. So a lot of the stuff you find online, like the kind of, you know, TechCrunch and web blogs and Gadget, and also tech magazines like Computer World and PC World, etc., yes, those are great technology magazines and great technology websites, but they're not particularly catered to the students. The students, from what we've understand, and everyone on the editorial board, including myself, is a student, is we want to know, what are the opportunities in industry? Where is the industry going? Told to us by experts in the field, top people in the field, and also how to leverage those opportunities. How do we get internships at Microsoft Research or AT&T Labs or, you know, Intel Research? How do we engage with them? These are really tough questions for people that are just starting their graduate careers, and certainly for people that are in their undergrads that don't realize these opportunities necessarily exist. I know when I was going from undergrad at New York University to PhD at Carnegie Mellon University, there were so many questions I had there and so many questions I had to answer myself and many questions that I'm still answering myself. And we're hoping that this publication can be the primary conduit to get people excited about those careers, and especially careers in kind of a professional venues, but also higher education, and encourage them to pursue a higher education degree in computer sciences and kind of technical fields. So it's really a multi-pronged effort, and I think you'll find, and we'll definitely send you a copy of the magazine, is that the content is really diverse. It's very much information-driven, but with a particular emphasis on information that's actionable by students. So it isn't just, this is the latest and greatest technology. They can find that in other areas. It's, this is the latest and greatest technology. Here are the people working on it. Here are the opportunities that exist as a student, and here are ways that you can get involved, and here are the people to contact. So it's really kind of a up-to-date newsletter for them to kind of jump right into some really high-level stuff.
Now, do you have sort of a social media, social networking relationships component to this sort of experience, and also a mobile component to this experience?
Right. We have right now a website that has ability for people to comment. There's also, we keep a Twitter feed of everything the editors are doing. There's a Facebook page. So we've tried to kind of branch out into multiple venues to engage people and give them up-to-date information. But the magazine itself, we actually publish inside of it these tweets and these kind of Facebook comments and these emails. So people that have reader feedback ends up in a special column that we call Inbox, where people can say, I really found this article interesting, or this article was terrible, I didn't learn anything, or there was some factual error. So we have a lot of different conduits for people to get back to us and help shape the magazine. We also, because this is a student magazine run by students, is we often get a lot of feedback just directly to us. So we go to conferences, and I say, you know, I'm the editor-in-chief of ACM Crossroads, and people say, hey, this is, you know, something that I want to see, or here's a topic that I'd be particularly interested in. Or occasionally I have people like academics say, you know, I really think that you guys need to do an article on you know, I don't know, like airplane technologies or something. You know, how do you write systems that are foolproof so they don't crash? And that's a huge issue, and we can often spawn and get a lot of their colleagues involved. We just actually did this for an issue on the future of interaction, which is kind of a topic close to my heart, where we got basically the top five people in the field to write articles. And most of those came from collaborations at conferences where people said, you know, I'm working on brain-computing interaction. And we say, well, that's fantastic. We really want to plug that into an issue that's going to be how we're going to be interacting with computers in, you know, 10 or 20 or 50 years' time. And so there was a collaboration opportunity right there. And then simultaneously with that, a lot of students are roped into that process. So we have a kind of a lead author, where I should rather say we have an academic author or a professional author that teams up with a number of students to kind of pull together these almost like summary articles.
Are you going to have a component or, you know, like a specific formatting of the content for a mobile platform as well? Or do you have that already?
We're, right now the website is accessible on kind of standard mobile devices, but we haven't launched a specific platform just for that. Of course, people that have, you know, Twitter and Facebook clients for their iPhones and Android devices and so on can subscribe to our different accounts and get information that way. But right now we have an RSS feed. There's a website launched. We're going to have special content that we're going to be throwing up on YouTube as well, kind of little lab exposés. So stay tuned. There's a lot of coming. We're just getting around to really relaunching the print version of this magazine, but there's a lot of cool things that are going to be happening on the web as well.
So it sounds like you're going to have the ability to do ranking and voting and that kind of thing as well.
We're working on those kind of features right now.
So expanding out from this great sort of publication, this redesigned Crossroads, I mean, it sounds really exciting. I can see the value in students out there because it's really specifically directed towards them and their interests. Like you're using your sort of relationships into the broader professional community to bring content in that'll be of value to them. You know, I could see all of that really being engaging. But going outside of that now and sort of talking about you specifically and your life, what experiences kind of shaped your work and maybe disruptive experiences shaped your life and work?
Well, I think probably the most significant kind of life experience that influenced me was traveling from an early age. My parents did a lot of traveling for their work, and that was certainly disruptive to my formal education. I missed, you know, 6 months of schooling at a time sometimes. But it didn't, I think, disrupt my kind of life education. So the neat thing about traveling is that you get kind of thrust into these fairly alien cultures, and certainly as a kid, that was, you know, quite an experience, and it really meant that I had to adapt quickly. It also taught me that people value different things. So here in Western countries, we're very much gadget and technology driven. But technology isn't the panacea for the whole world. You know, a farmer in rural China would probably find a web server, you know, pretty useless to them. He'd probably much rather, you know, put money into fixing his tractor. So if we are to build technologies that we hope will be used on a global scale, we really need to, you know, grapple with this and realize this. I think we're kind of blinded by that in kind of this iPhone and, you know, laptop and digital protectors everywhere kind of vision, but that isn't necessarily the experience of the rest of the world. And I think traveling, although it was certainly disruptive to my kind of early education, actually turned out to be immensely beneficial to kind of opening my eyes to the realization that people are different. And technology is a fantastic tool that can aid people's lives. But you can't just throw technology at a problem. It has to be a technological solution to something that's really facing people. And, you know, back to kind of the example of a farmer in China, we can't just, you know, say, oh, we need to give your kids an education and here's 10 laptops. I think that's the wrong approach. It needs to have a better understanding of what the problems they're facing are. And if the problem they're facing is his tractor's broken and there's no food, a laptop isn't going to fix that. He needs to, you know, you need to have simultaneously people not only get the technology, but want the technology. You can't just force things on top of people. It'll just end up in the, you know, the corner gathering dust. And to realize that, you really need to understand this incredible kind of complex situation. There's a lot of dynamics in play to how people use technology, what they place value on. Is it the information? You know, is his ability to check Wikipedia that interesting, or would he rather communicate with his relatives in America? There's so many different factors, and we really need to understand all those. And they're complicated questions, and there's a lot of very smart people working on those questions now.
And that kind of reminds me of two conversations I had, one with Kishore Swaminathan, and he's the founder of the labs at Accenture, and he's also the chief scientist. And he and he talks about this whole idea of technology and, you know, its impact it's going to have on developing nations, and really quite fascinating. Some of his ideas are pretty provocative, so I think the audience, sort of invite them to have a look at his work. But also, it brings to mind Brewer's wireless hypothesis, and do you have any comment on that at all? And, you know, sort of his idea of the impact of wireless technologies and how it can perhaps have a great impact on GDP, and rather than focusing on infrastructure, but that itself will produce increases in infrastructure because it will help raise the GDP of the country so they can afford other kinds of things.
Right. I mean, I think technology and certainly kind of blanket wireless, I mean, wireless technologies is somewhat unique in that you can blanket entire areas. So the infrastructure cost, while high, has the ability to impact millions and millions of people. I still think that vision has to be tempered with the fact that you're blanketing communities that don't even necessarily have running water. So to have a phone does not necessarily bring in the money that's going to be necessary for infrastructural improvements like, you know, sanitation and running water. Those are things that, you know, are killing people now, and giving them a laptop with wireless connectivity isn't going to solve. So it's still a very complex thing. But yes, absolutely. Technology, I think, has shown us at this point that wireless communication, which can deliver information, communication, and computational resources from the cloud. So you can have an email account, you know, hosted by Gmail, for example, is probably the kind of cloud computing service that people interact with fairly regularly, has tremendous benefits both socially and economically. This is going to lift a huge number of people out of kind of an information dark era, and also lift them out of poverty simultaneously. And I think this is happening. People are seeing, and I actually had an opportunity to ask a question to Bill Gates, and had a whole bunch of answers around this topic, was people were saying that, oh, isn't it really unfortunate that all these jobs are going overseas, you know, to India or being offshore? There was a real worry in the computer science community back when this question was asked, and this was like 3 or 4 years ago at this point. And he said, no, you've got it all wrong. This is actually a remarkable opportunity. The fact that all of a sudden jobs in technology are going overseas shows that millions and millions of people have now achieved education levels that are approaching on par with their Western counterparts, and that they're qualified enough to take on extremely complicated positions, and they're being lifted out of poverty by the millions. So it's globalization at work, and yes, it really stings when you lose your job, but that is opening up, you know, 10 opportunities in another country, and that's a remarkable transformation that's happened within the past 20 or 30 years. And China has certainly, you know, accelerated even beyond that at this point. So this is really a transformation that's happened because of the kind of information era and the computing era. I don't think we should look back, and I think we should embrace it and realize the tremendous benefit it's having worldwide.
You know, past, present, and future, name someone who inspires you and why this is so.
It's really hard to pick, I think, a single person. There's been so many people that have given me tremendous amounts of their time and effort and love and mentorship. It's really hard to pull it down to one. I think one of the reasons I've been able to enjoy the success I have is because of the incredible kind of effort that people have invested in me. And one of the reasons why I've taken on this kind of editor-in-chief role is another opportunity for me to give back to the community from which I've drawn a tremendous amount of knowledge and expertise and kind of attention from. But one person I think in particular that I think I should mention is actually a family friend called Gene Brewer. And it's someone I had met at a young age, quite fortuitously, when looking for a chess mentor in my apartment building. So I must only have been about 10 or 11 or 12 at the time. And my parents posted, you know, a little notice saying, you know, 10-year-old boy looking for, you know, chess mentor. And sure enough, this guy in the apartment building picked it up. You know, we played a couple games of chess. It became very apparent to me, even though he thought I would be some prodigy, that I was actually terrible at chess. And so we instead went off and kind of did a lot of science things. And I was growing up in New York City at the time, and so we went off to the kind of Natural History Museum and watched kind of, you know, movies on science. And him being very much a scientist, his background, he actually has a PhD, I think, in microbiology. Fantastically smart man. And that passion and that kind of interest and curiosity really kind of caught on with me. And I think it definitely influenced my direction into the sciences and the technology. Simultaneous with that, he's an interesting man because he decided to leave that career entirely and become a writer, a novelist, and went on to write books for much of the rest of his career. So he had kind of the courage to pursue what he thought was a field best for him. And certainly being a writer is no easy task, but, you know, enjoyed a lot of his books being published and, you know, a few being bestsellers in several countries. So definitely a very successful man that I look up to tremendously.
And if you look over your life and your career, what were challenges that you were not able to overcome?
Well, unfortunately, despite, you know, the fact that my parents bought me that computer, is that my handwriting has still remained extremely poor. And it is sometimes challenging for people to understand what I write. But more seriously, is a problem that I face continually being in academia is technology transfer. So there's so many fantastic people and so many fantastic companies and universities working on amazing things, but the kind of the viscosity, the kind of technological viscosity in those communities is extremely high. So even if I come up with something that's really interesting, a kind of a new interaction technique that could be very, you know, powerful, and I would love to see on mobile phones, getting that onto the desk of the people that make those decisions is really hard. So, and I think a great example of this is Apple. So Apple is very much a kind of an inward-looking company. They develop everything in-house. They don't really attend the conferences that are supposed to be these distribution platforms. But yet they're highly innovative, and they kind of use that as their trade secret. And that's fantastic. Microsoft, on the other hand, has a huge publishing model. In fact, I would suspect that they are the highest publishing rate company of most in most of the ACM conferences, and probably maybe even IEEE conferences. Certainly in my field, they are the top publisher in my field. And that means their researchers go and mingle with all the academics and share, and there's a huge amount of kind of information exchange and idea exchange. And I think that's led to some pretty important improvements. So I think there's a couple different models at play, but even overall, even if I came up with an amazing technology, you know, during this interview, my ability to approach Microsoft and demo it to them would be extremely hard. I think IP issues in the U.S. and kind of the Western nations in general has become so complicated and so vicious in many cases. I mean, Nokia and Apple are all suing each other now, and HTC is getting in on it. It's just so complicated and so expensive that for exchange to happen, and even more importantly, for kind of a student or an academic or an independent inventor, the ability for them to make an impact is severely diminished by this incredible viscosity. And so it's something that I deal with fairly regularly and don't have a good answer for. I wish it wasn't the case. But academic conferences are at least the first step to getting people to meet and at least discuss. It doesn't solve the problem of kind of IP licensing and exchange and protection, but at least it gets the people together. And I think that's been hugely influential in kind of my creative pursuits. And I encourage your listeners to go and kind of reevaluate. If they haven't been to an academic conference in a while, pick a topic they're really interested in and go to one. They might be surprised.
What are the top lessons that you want to share with a broad audience?
Top lessons. Well, I think something that I subscribe to is this kind of work hard, play hard attitude. Creativity is very much important to me, and to nurture that, I think you need experiences. That's kind of the cannon fodder for creativity. As I mentioned before, I've traveled a lot, maybe to about 40 or 50 countries at this point, and I think that gives me a lot of perspective and stories and experiences and people that I've met that I draw upon when I'm thinking about kind of creative ways to solve problems. There's even kind of things that I do that are just totally goofy. So, 2 summers ago, while doing my studies in Pittsburgh, I decided to build a raft with 2 of my friends and raft down the Allegheny River for 3 days. And there was no real point to this other than it was kind of an adventure. We built a raft ourselves out of 2x4s and netting and a canopy, you know, a rudder attached to it, and packed it full of food in a tent and just went down the river for 3 days. Very much kind of Huckleberry Finn style. I think the soul needs those kinds of adventures to be fired up, and I try to engage in those in a fairly regular, you know, interval, just to keep life interesting and things that I want to do on the tip of my tongue and keep me kind of excited. And then when I come back to the lab, I draw a lot of that enthusiasm with me, and that I think has led to a lot of my successful projects.
You know, you are editor-in-chief of ACM Crossroads, so what factors make for effective communications in writing?
Well, I write very specific sorts of documents, mostly academic papers, so I can't promise they generalize, but I'll share the kind of 3 hooks that my papers have. So the first is that there needs to be something new, something novel. You want to get people excited about what they're reading. So you want to tell them something they haven't read before, or present a technology they may not be familiar with or haven't learned about or never even experienced. Then you kind of zoom in a little bit in the middle, and you kind of need to back it up with facts. So to say you invented a teleporter is very exciting. Then after the 3rd paragraph, people can be like, well, I don't understand how this is happening, or, you know, if this is real. So you need to very much back up your novel idea, your kind of hook, with facts, or kind of an evaluation of some sort, which happens in my field. And then finally, after you've kind of said, this is something new, they're excited, then you've backed it up and they're like, I believe you, then you need to paint the vision of what it could be used for. How is it going to be influential? How is it going to be used, you know, and how am I going to see it manifested in a real technological device? And I think that what happens is they get excited, then they get a little more excited that it's real, and then at the end you get them really excited because they're realizing that this might actually end up in their pocket or on their desk at some point in the future. So that's kind of the three phases that I think a lot of my papers adhere to.
How would you describe your top innovative achievements in terms of, you know, what inspired these innovations? What were the factors that made the innovations possible? What problems were you trying to solve? Your solutions and the impact it has today and into the longer term future?
Well, okay, it's a very long question. So what I'm going to do is I'll pick a particular project that had a very kind of simple premise that opened up a lot of different research projects subsequently. So one observation I made early on during my kind of PhD studies is that we have these small devices, but they often end up resting on large tables. So the device is small, but it's situated on this kind of large surface area like a table. And what I wondered is, you know, rather than having to play with these little tiny buttons on these devices, wouldn't it be fantastic if that device could somehow appropriate all that surface area of the table and use the table as the interactive surface? So sort of like, you know, having your iPod off to the side of your desk, maybe even buried in papers, but you can advance the song just by kind of drawing a gesture right on the table, sort of like it was a large trackpad. And this inspired a project called Scratch Input, which basically had a little tiny microphone installed on the back of a mobile phone, or like an iPod, an iPhone, a cell phone, whatever, even a laptop, and it could listen to the acoustics inside of the table. And in particular, we listened to the resonant frequency of the human fingernail. This is why we call it Scratch Input. So basically, you kind of like scratch your gestures onto the table, and the device can hear that because the sound is actually being transmitted through the surface of the table. And this is actually an effect that you can readily demonstrate yourself by putting your ear against a wall or a table and then having someone like tap on the opposite end. The transmission quality is really good through solid materials, and so you can hear it perfectly well. In fact, as kind of a subsequent experiment, you could try to put your, you know, ears against the wall, close your eyes, and have someone draw a series of letters. And if you try hard enough, you'll probably find that you can guess a number of the letters because they sound quite different. A P has a very different kind of acceleration and movement profile than the letter M or the letter O or the letter A. And so you're able to guess them fairly well, and a computer can listen to all this information and actually classify a lot of different gestures, including letters or circles or, you know, numbers or taps and double taps. So it really opened up this idea of I could basically walk into a coffee shop, throw down my phone in the corner of the table, and then if it rang, I could, you know, maybe write S on the table for it to go to silent. I could write, you know, a W for who's calling, and it'd say, you know, your mother is calling, and I'd be like, okay, let me, you know, I can't take that right now. Maybe I'll try that again in 5 minutes. And so it kind of initiated this idea that devices could be small, but that their interactions didn't have to be. And certainly not have to be as small as the physical device itself. And that set up this kind of whole slew of projects, and I mentioned one of them already, Skinput, where you have small devices appropriating surface area from the environment, which allowed them to keep their interactive capabilities quite high, even though they'd basically be unusable if you were stuck on the device itself.
That's really quite interesting and, you know, ties into your life's work at this point. So I'm really kind of excited, looking forward to some of this being implemented in, you know, on devices that we use every day.
It's coming. I can't say much, but there might be some things in the pipeline.
Now, there's this other concept of mentoring, and I'm sure you've been mentored and you've mentored others, and sometimes I use this word called leg, providing a leg up or being a life experience guide to some other person. So how can you provide a leg up for those transitioning in their careers? In other words, what kind of career tips can you provide to those people out there who want to, you know, move up in their careers, or students who want to become a professional in some way, or who want to engage in a professional track in some way? I mean, what kind of advice can you give to those people out there?
Well, something that has served me very well, I mean, I think there's lots of diverse opinions on this, but I can comment on my experiences, is to listen to your peers and your elders. I think people don't listen enough. If you do listen, people are going to tell you some fantastic advice and point you in the right direction. I rely tremendously on my parents, on my PhD advisor, on my friends, because technology is moving now so fantastically fast, you cannot hope to keep up with all of it. And so you need kind of this web of resources, this network of resources, to really keep your pulse on where technology is going. And especially for people that are older and more experienced than you, their experiences are invaluable. Computing is so much about the skill. It's very much a skill-driven field. I think of it almost like kind of, you know, glass work or ceramics. It's almost like we need an apprenticeship model for some of the skills that we see in this kind of computing domain. And so live up to that standard. Learn the skills and the nuances from people that have had those kind of lifelong experiences and tap them, lean on them. And what I found is that they are always happy to share their advice. These are people, for the most part, especially if they get to that level in their career, that are technologists at their heart. These are people that love technology and breathe technology. And if you ask them about technology, they will tell you all about it. So definitely leverage people and listen to what they have to say, and I think you'll be surprised. There's just so much out there. I think you could go up to almost any technologist, you know, someone who loves technology, and say, you know, what is something funky that you've seen on the blogs, on YouTube, whatever, and almost certainly they've seen something that you haven't. I don't think that's even possible, you know, today to have something that you've seen everything that someone else has seen. So definitely lean on your friends and peers and elders, et cetera.
You know, something that I've coming across in this conversation is that you're always involved or participating in some kind of innovation, and that is, let's say, as editor-in-chief of ACM Crossroads, or you work at IBM Research, you work at AT&T Labs, you work with Microsoft Research, you work with Disney Imagineering. There's always this constant thread of innovation. So let's turn that around then. What specific qualities make you excel at innovating?
This, I think, actually is a simple question for me to answer. And I don't think it's the same answer for every single person, but I think it certainly is true for me. I think what you need to be an innovator is creativity. Now, that may seem obvious, but creativity is a very elusive thing. Creativity, to look at a problem with a unique perspective and then find an equally unique way to solve it, is a really daunting challenge. There's, you know, if you look at technology around you, it's easy to say, oh my word, everything must be invented. That's what people said, you know, when, you know, the first car came out, or when, like, you know, the first train was, oh, and now it's, everything's been invented. Electricity's been invented. There's nothing more beyond this. But time and time again, innovators have pushed the bar forward. And especially in computing, which is, you know, a field that's only been around for 50 years, no one can argue about the tremendous advances that have happened during this time. I mean, computers are like 8,000 times faster than they were, you know, 30 years ago or something. Unbelievable. And that's because of people innovating all over the place and in lots of different fields. And I think the way they've been able to push forward and relook at these problems is creativity. So kind of a quote that I think about often in my work is, I think it's a Henry Ford quote, and I'm likely to butcher it, but it went something along the lines of this. If I asked people, you know, would they want to, you know, to invent the kind of the car, they would have asked for a faster horse instead. It's because they were looking very much in the same mindset, kind of the same lens that they were, of the world they were in. But you needed someone like Henry Ford to say, no, you know, it's not a faster horse. I'm going to go something down a totally different path, and it's going to be the automobile. And so that is a lens, I think, that people who want to innovate have to constantly look through. When they look at an opportunity, they look at a problem, they say, okay, let's not just make the, you know, a bigger touchscreen or add an extra button here. That's just design. What you need is someone to really push the envelope and go for something that's totally unique, like turning your table into the interactive surface, something that's just funky that people wouldn't necessarily have thought about previously.
Well, you know, your answer kind of reminds me of Gladwell's Outliers, where my sense of that book is he talks about talent sufficiency, that's sufficient talent, hard work, where he talks about 10,000 hours. He talks about having a good environment when you were young and having that sort of supportive environment. But he also talks about creativity being an essential element, so kind of very much ties in with what you're talking about.
Absolutely, yes.
What resources would you recommend?
Well, clearly there's lots of resources. I think the five that I would say that I rely on the most, I'll go through them one at a time here, is I think first friends, which I've mentioned before. I learn a tremendous amount from them directly. But even if they don't know something, they can almost always, you know, kind of kick me in the right direction, which is really valuable to get that running start. Second are tech websites. So in order to keep up on the latest developments, because there is just so many, you need someone there kind of synthesizing it all for you. So reading Gizmodo, reading Engadget, really important, at least for me as kind of a technologist. And also kind of along with that are reading the blogs. So there's a lot of very smart people commenting on technology and giving their perspectives and drawing it together. So it isn't just a linear news feed of here's a new TV and here's a new laptop and this got that much faster and that got that much smaller, but actually someone commenting and tying it all together and listening to podcasts like yours so that you can find the interesting people and pull out kind of the interesting tidbits from the noise. And there is a lot of noise. Fourth, which is another thing that I've mentioned previously, is go to conferences. Your listeners might think they're a bit kind of stuffy and academic, and they wouldn't be entirely wrong, to be honest. But what you do get from conferences, which you can't get anywhere else, is hear the absolute cutting-edge stuff in those fields being delivered by top, top experts, and that's both in academia and industry. There's no real other place you can go to just walk up to someone who invented, you know, parallel computing and ask them a question on it. You need to go to the conference and do that in hand. A website can't do that for you. And finally, I would encourage people to read publications like XRDS. They are, you know, this, again, people hard at work drawing together these things and getting important interviews with people to summarize this incredible content, picking through the noise to find the interesting things and delivering it to you. So instead of it being a kind of a web-based form, it's a print-based form. And in some ways, that allows to capture particular information you can't get on the web. And because, for instance, Crossroads is a quarterly magazine, we really spend a long time, you know, 3-month cycles gathering, you know, the best people to comment on the best technologies. So our articles this time around are written by a number of academics, but also people at places like Autodesk and Intel and Microsoft and IBM, really top people working on the top problems. So definitely, I think all those 5 things are really important to keep up on.
Well, I'm just going to drill down a little bit further. So on publications, you talked about Crossroads and you mentioned Friends, but do you have any specific websites, blogs, and conferences that you can recommend?
So the ones that I go to fairly regularly, although it kind of ebbs and flows with my availability, are the main ones like TechCrunch, Engadget, Gizmodo. I also visit some of the Apple rumor sites, which is a little more unusual, like MacRumors.com, just because they often have really interesting commentary and kind of exposés on patents that Apple, you know, like patents that have just been disclosed by Apple. And that's always a really interesting way to see kind of a glimpse into what Apple's thinking about. And certainly as a cutting-edge company, it's important to keep kind of tabs on them. And other than that, I kind of just read the general news sites like BBC News and CNN because I still think a world perspective is really important. But other than that, I don't actually visit a huge number of those websites. A lot of my other kind of information gathering is through friends, going to conferences, and, you know, working, for example, on XRDS is an incredible opportunity to talk with people and interact with them.
So what are 3 top conferences you would recommend?
Well, it's very much specific to your field. So in my field, which is a human-computer interaction, the top conference is arguably ACM CHI, C-H-I, which stands for Computer-Human Interaction. The last one was just a few months ago. That's where I presented Skinput and a number of other technologies I had been working on. And there's also, you know, SIGGRAPH, which is a massive conference, you know, thousands and thousands of attendees, and has all sorts of fantastically interesting demonstrations and new technologies being presented there. Beyond that, it gets a little more specific. There's the conference that I would say I publish in kind of equally with Kai is a conference called WIST, and that's spelled U-I-S-T, and it's the User Interfaces Software and Technology Conference. In fact, that's coming up, so I encourage your listeners to consider attending. It's in New York City this year round. And it's a much smaller conference. There's maybe only 200 or 300 people that go, but it really is kind of the creme de la creme of the interaction and kind of user interface community. So if you want to see where interaction technologies are going to be in 5 or 10 years, when academia is often way ahead of the curve, that is the conference to go to. And I can say, I think there's going to be some very exciting new technologies there this year. Hopefully, you know, 1 or 2 of my own.
Have you ever attended any of the TED conferences at all?
I have not. I mean, they kind of have come to light, I think, more prominently in the past, you know, 2 or 3 years with some very high-profile speakers, but no, I have not had an opportunity to attend. Unfortunately, as a grad student, my budget is somewhat limited, and I think the registration fee is quite high.
Now, can you provide your technology roadmap for the future?
Well, I mean, I'm pushing on a number of initiatives simultaneously. The one that I've kind of alluded to a couple times in this interview has this notion of devices kind of miniaturizing, maybe, you know, down to the size of a box of matches that are essentially just, you know, have space for one button, which is the power on button, and have no screen and maybe no other buttons at all. but instead take advantage of the environment as their interactive kind of canvas. So you push it up against the wall, you put it in your hand, you project on the skin, you use a table, and so on. You kind of gesture in the air like Project Natal, and so on. And I think what people are going to see, and this is kind of the vision that I'm seeing, is that devices are going to become kind of so small and so diminutive, they're essentially going to disappear. You could put three of them in your pocket. And also you're going to have environments that are fantastically smart, but also kind of have technology that's disappeared. And this is a vision that is kind of rehashed from a number of different people. It's kind of just a new look on it. So you can imagine for some kind of a technology like Skinput or a project like Natal, is that you could walk into your living room and you want to turn on your TV. And instead of having to reach for a remote control, which is just packed full of buttons that arguably is not very well designed, instead you can just open up your hand and your computer, either the computer on your body or the kind of computer in your house, knows you're approaching the TV, you're opening your hand, you're doing this very explicit gesture. And what these devices do is render essentially like a remote control on your hand. And so you basically just open your palms, you know, while you're sitting down, and projected right there in your palm is a remote control, and you can hit power on, and then you can dial in the channel, or go up and down, or, you know, do a search right there. And what's neat is that it doesn't require any devices, really. You're kind of just like, it's almost summoning interfaces on your body like magic. So you can imagine the same interface. You walk into your kitchen, and you open your hands again, and this time there's an interface that says what's in the fridge, and what the recipe of the day is, and, you know, your husband's 20 minutes late from work, and, you know. There's so many things you can do once you have that kind of ubiquity in computing and input and output. And I think that is a really exciting future. We're not quite there yet, but the jigsaw pieces are falling into place that are going to enable this type of future.
Well, the interesting thing is you're actually working in research in this area, so you see things prior to them appearing in the marketplace. And what do you see as the time lag between the work that you're working on and when we will see it, when the average person will have it?
I mean, as I said before, technology transfer is a very complicated beast, and so it's really hard to estimate. The project that I did with Microsoft Research, Skinput, which is, again, this kind of interface projected on the body and using your skin as the interactive canvas, is an active project still at Microsoft, and they're saying kind of within 2 to 7 years, and they have that big kind of wide gap in there because it's just too hard to know what device is going to get traction with and potentially get deployed into the market. But nonetheless, what has been kind of emerging is that digital projectors are now becoming really small. And so, you know, the newest generation is going to be the size of about a sugar cube, or maybe a little bit bigger than that, fantastically small, which is going to enable their integration into a wide range of devices. And because a lot of them will be laser-based, there's not going to be focusing issues. So it doesn't matter if you're close or far, they're automatically in focus because there's actually a kind of an RGB laser scanning across the surface. And that, I think, is going to say, now people are going to say, now we can project on a lot of different things. How are we going to do the input? And that is an open problem, but nonetheless, the projectors, once they get out there and people start adopting that technology, it's going to gather steam and people are going to start demanding extra interactive capabilities. I mean, in much the same way the internet kind of, you know, snowballed because it had critical mass, I think that people are going to start adopting that technology en masse and it'll become kind of pervasive fairly quickly. But nonetheless, you know, a lot of these technologies are probably 5 or 10 years out. So, and that's typical. So to give you an example, the iPhone. The iPhone actually didn't do much that was super new. People credit it with a lot, but multi-touch existed in the 70s. People were doing it on devices in the 70s. The key thing here is that they were mocking it up. They were mocking up basically an iPhone with a computer the size of a refrigerator. So the interaction techniques were defined. What wasn't defined is, you know, a device that was good enough to actually pull it off. So what Apple did is very cleverly and very successfully is wrap up all of these techniques and a very nice implementation of kind of touch sensing and multi-touch sensing into a form factor that's palatable for consumers. And that's very much a design challenge, and they executed it very well. But the technology itself, nothing in there is particularly new. People in the academic community could point to papers from 10 or 15 or even 20 years ago that implemented everything that the iPhone does. So, in fact, even Apple kind of videos from like the late 80s had a lot of these technologies kind of mocked up in videos. That used to be a really popular thing at Apple, is to mock up these kind of technology videos. It just took, you know, 10 or 15 years even in industry to get to that level of refinement. So it's at the same stage for academic projects, unfortunately.
Now, do you see any particular country taking a real leadership role in terms of all the technologies you're talking about, or do you feel that it's fairly equally distributed around the world?
Unfortunately, I don't think it's equally distributed. That's something that I'd very much like to see, but I don't think we're quite there yet. But so I think right now the U.S. is definitely kind of the superpower in technology innovation. But kind of per capita, which is an important kind of measure to go by, is you see places like Finland and Canada and France and Italy all, you know, actually doing really quite well. I think Finland actually has, like, in terms of my field, is maybe the most productive per capita. So it is somewhat level. I mean, the EU kind of has to be taken en masse because it's just got so many people, but individually they're not going to be able to compete with the U.S. But nonetheless, I think what has always kind of characterized the kind of American spirit is this very kind of pioneering and creative attitude. I think that's very much in the national psyche. And so, in fact, all of really North America, to be fair. And so I think that has very much carried over to a tradition of technology innovation and computing innovation. The Europeans definitely have some tremendous research institutions, and Japan as well. And the rest of the world is quickly catching up. I mean, the Chinese are having an incredible presence in the computing sciences now, India as well, Brazil. So I think the kind of acceleration of these countries is going to put them on par quicker than we might think. But unfortunately, it's not quite there yet.
This is a fairly open question, and you choose the topic area. What do you see as the top challenges facing us today, and how do you propose they be solved?
Well, that is an absolutely massive question. On a smaller kind of note, is because there's many, many challenges in computer science, and certainly if you expand that to, you know, challenges facing us in the world and how technology can solve them, that is a gargantuan kind of answer, and we could spend another 2 hours talking about that. But the kind of the challenge that I'm facing right now, and I mentioned also briefly, is that digital projectors are becoming really small. And so all of our devices, you know, potentially could one day have a little digital projector on them. They're going to become small and very cheap. And what's nice about projectors is that they are very small themselves, but they can project onto very large things. So although the projector is small, the output is large. And that's a very nice kind of property. And what I am looking at, and other researchers are looking at, is what's the analog for input? And we don't really have a good answer to that. So basically I'm trying to say is how do we have input larger than a device? Because right now, input is very much about buttons and touchscreens, but that means input is the size of the device, not larger than the device like a projector would have. And so that's a really significant problem, and I think it's holding back mobile devices. And a lot of my research is looking at kind of unusual ways to achieve that vision. I think if we can realize that vision and we can make mobile devices potentially as usable and as strong of computing platforms as a desktop computer, there's really remarkable things that we could do. Until that happens, we're never going to write, you know, documents on our iPhones. They're going to be very much kind of information consumption devices and not information creation and not even really information communication devices. No one writes a really long email on their, you know, smartphones, but they certainly will shoot off a quick message. And not because the keyboard is good, but because they'll just about manage because they like it to be small. We don't want people to take technology and manage with it because it happens to be small. We want people to take a device and be highly capable with it and not constrained by its small physicality. And that seems like a very specific problem, but it's going to open up a lot of opportunities for mobile devices and kind of computing on the go. And really this idea of how do we achieve ubiquity in computing everywhere we go. And that's a problem that I think about all the time.
Well, you know, Chris, imagine now you're presenting at a conference in 2020 and you're describing the common experience of the worker that's out there. What do you envision that experience will be when they're doing their work on some kind of computing device?
It's really hard to envision exactly what that's going to be like. But as I said before, I think with the notion of projectors and input, both of which are larger than the device they have. So you might have a device that's basically equivalent to like a bracelet, very small. But you're going to be able to project on the environment, you're going to be able to project on yourself, you're going to be able to, your glasses are going to be able to project. It's going to be some kind of mix between augmented reality and magic. You're going to be able to just summon interactive capabilities on regular objects. It's going to, for all practical purposes, it's going to look like ordinary things in the world are computers because you've infused them with computational abilities through these devices. So you'll be able to walk up to a restaurant table and project on it and do input on it. And then when you move to the airport, you'll be able to, you know, use a seat for input. You'll be able to, as you're walking, use the sidewalk to display a map. It's really going to just sprinkle computation everywhere, but importantly, not because there's infrastructure sprinkled everywhere. So a lot of visions in computing have drawn up this notion that technology will become so cheap that infrastructure, like computing infrastructure, will just be everywhere. There'll be displays everywhere that we can walk up to and use. I personally don't think that's going to ever happen because infrastructure is not only expensive, but it's also incredibly complicated to maintain and guarantee privacy on it, et cetera, et cetera. So I see it as very much as you carry basically a little self-contained infrastructure with you, and you leverage the environment for these interactive capabilities. Leverage objects, leverage the things around you. And in many ways, that means taking advantage of this surface area so you can do nice big gestures and not have to be constrained to some ridiculously small touchscreen. And I think you'll find for the average worker and for the information worker and for even just, you know, trying to order lunch, you know, as you're trying to navigate to some restaurant in the city, you're going to use interactions that are very much like magic.
Now, Chris, I have just one final question, and this is a very broad question. It's not really related to specific technologies or technology categories or areas that we've talked about so far in this discussion. It's about IT as a profession or computing as a profession, just as medicine is a profession or engineering is a profession, accounting is a profession. And there's this group called the United Nations Founded International Federation for Information Processing, and they've launched an initiative called IP3, and the whole sort of purpose of this initiative is to kind of create a profession out of computing, so that's sort of recognized like the other professions with bodies of knowledge and accreditation processes and standards and so on, and even a certification process or where professionals can be certified, and there's some mobility or recognition of that certification. Do you have any comments about that at all, or do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, overall, I think that's a positive move. I think, as I kind of mentioned before, computer science and kind of IT work is very much a skill-based field. It's like engineering, or it's like glass blowing, or it's like ceramics, or it's like tile work, or carpentry. We work with our hands, but in a very kind of new digital medium. But it's very much a skill-based discipline. And in that respect, I think kind of having standards or accreditation processes can actually be really valuable to provide a level, a level playing field and to give people a certain level of skill. I mean, there's, you have in kind of a workshop, let's say a glassblowing workshop, where you have the master glassblower and a couple people below him and then a couple of apprentices. And for, that has been proven to be an effective kind of skill transfer model for millennia, essentially. I mean, as far back as, mankind goes for craft making. And obviously there is some success there, and it's something that I think could pay dividends in a very technical and extremely complicated field like computer science. The education load on new graduates taking CS or IT courses is immense, and they come out you can't come out of your undergraduate training and build Microsoft Word, because the systems today are just huge and really complicated moving parts. It's like asking an automotive engineer to build an entire car. It's just not possible. So you need to have a kind of an iterative kind of skill-based kind of development of these people. And simultaneously, and a really important skill, is how do you work with teams of people? And I think professional organizations, drawing those people together and having kind of networking opportunities and training opportunities, also could be incredibly important. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting sort of take on, creating a profession out of technology and out of computing and having standards and codes of ethics and some kind of professional bodies that provide a sense of belonging as well. And you have to have demonstrated continuing professional development, so it manages risk, ensures quality standards, and I believe those are all good things. And it will, provide sort of more of a solid base to computing. And I think those are the things that you're also saying is in your sort of response. So, Well, Chris, we are at the end of this interview, and you have this great history in technology, innovation, and research. And you're already making significant societal contributions. I know the audience is very much looking forward to seeing you and your work with Crossroads, because it's being revitalized to be much more tech savvy and very targeted. And I'm very much looking forward to seeing this coming out. So, we thank you for taking this time, and we're indeed fortunate that you did come in to do the interview. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
I'm Stephen Ibraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Chris Harrison, Editor-in-Chief of ACM Crossroads and Microsoft Research PhD Fellow.